So good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Balkan Gallery on this fall day. And we are here for an archival discussion in relation to Carol Itter's artistic practice and the exhibition that you see all around you called Carol Itter, Only When I'm Hauling Water Do I Wonder If I'm Getting Any Stronger. I'm Naomi Sawada, and I manage public programs at the Balkan Gallery. And before we start, a couple of housekeeping tips. This presentation is going to be documented, audio only. So during the Q&A section, if you do not wish to be recorded, you're welcome. Bahar Moabzabnia, who is waving her hand back there, you're welcome to write your questions down on a piece of paper, and we will read them out. And so please just be mindful of sound during this presentation. I'd like to introduce three of our panelists first, and then we'll please, if you're going to acknowledge or clap or anything, please do that afterwards. So first of all, I'd like to introduce Carol Itter, who is to your right, my left. Many of you will already know about Carol, but for those who don't, Carol's an artist, a writer, a performer, and a filmmaker, and a photographer. Itter began her fine arts studies at the University of British Columbia and then continued to the Vancouver School of Art, which we all now know is Emily Carr University. And then she went to Rome for the Accademia delle Belle Arti. And she is also worked as a seasonal theater under the STARS professional, doing scenes as well as other projects in Vancouver. Solo exhibitions of her work include the Western Front, the Ore Gallery, the Grunt, Open Space, Vancouver Art Gallery, SFU Galleries, at the O'Dayne Gallery, the Balkan Gallery, and her work was included in WAC, Art of the Feminist Revolution, which was down at the Vancouver Art Gallery, for those of you who saw it, in 2008. It really sort of opened up a lot of conversations about what hadn't been talked about in Vancouver prior to that. She was also part of Traffic, Conceptual Art in Canada, which also toured across Canadian institutions from 2010 to 2013. And she's also an author of Whistle, Daughter, Whistle. And with Daphne Marlett, she compiled and edited Opening Doors in 1975. And that's an archive of oral history about Vancouver's East End. Carol has collaborated with artist and musician Al Neal, and many of you will have known about the Blue Cabin, which was in North Vancouver, and starting in the late 1970s, it has continued to be now an over 35-year artist residency. The cabin was a place of inspiration and art production for her while she maintained her own residence and studio in the Vancouver neighborhood of Strathcona, where she's lived since the early 1970s. So her work is included in several collections, the Morrison Belkin Art Gallery, the SFU Galleries, Vancouver Art Gallery, Burnaby Art Gallery, Surrey Art Gallery, Nanaimo Art Gallery, and the Canada Council Art Bank, and the Vancouver Public Library. And she was awarded with the Viva Award in 1989 and the O'Dayne Prize in 2017. That's a lot, Carol. Okay, Brandon Leung, who is to Carol's left, your right, holds a BA in English with a minor in art history from the University of BC, and he received an MA in photography and preservation and collections management from the Toronto Metropolitan University. He has worked in numerous cultural institutions, including the UBC Library and the Balkan Gallery, where he helped to accession and catalog Carol's archive. Leung currently works in the Department of Art History, Visual Art and Theory, and is, oh my gosh, I haven't printed out the last page of your bio. And so consequently, Dan, I'm sorry that I don't have your bio written down either. So maybe, I do know Dan as, he's happy with that. I do know Dan as many of you will know that he is the archivist at Grunt Gallery, and he's also a librarian at Langara College and has worked, yes?
Yeah,
he's also worked very closely with Carol on a number of projects through the Grunt. So what I'm going to do is we're going to have each of the people who are have worked with Carol. Brandon will go first. then Dan, but Carol, you are very welcome at any time to discuss or respond to some of the things that are being raised by the experiences of Brandon as well as Dan. Okay?
So. I can go? Okay, great. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming to this talk. I'd like to just add on to what Naomi just said. I first would like to make an acknowledgement towards the archival and collections team at the Belkin. Even though I'm the one up behind the table here, there are many people who've had a hand in forming Carol's archive to how it is now and how it lives at the Belkin. So I'd like to thank Teresa, who is the registrar of the Belkin, Anna, who's the archivist, Tiana and Natalie, who are also student workers in the archive at the Belkin, just like myself, and Dr. Jennifer Douglas of the iSchool, who has also done work in parts of Carol's archive. I'd also like to thank Carol herself for allowing me into her home and making me breakfast sometimes.
He gave you the keys.
Gave me the keys, too. There's a lot of trust up there. I'd like to start off with that. And again, as Naomi said, my background is in photographic preservation, collections management. And so my entryway in kind of working with Carol's archive, I was kind of at the very beginning. I was a Young Canada Works student worker working with Anna and Teresa. And near the end of my time here, I think they were just about to start, you know, collecting Carol's materials into the Belkin, and they asked me if I would like to help visit her and facilitate the process. And I said, yeah, sure, that sounds fun. And so I wanted to, so I worked with her for about a month. Like Carol just said, she gave me the key, so I had pretty free access, didn't exploit that privilege, obviously. But I think I'd like to start this off with a little anecdote. I don't know if you remember Carol saying this to Teresa, but Teresa was the one who first called Carol, I believe, and asked her, is it okay if this student worker of ours comes over to your home and helps go through your stuff? And I think she must have told Carol about my background in photographic preservation, because apparently Carol said to her, oh, but I'm not a photographer. I don't know if you remember.
Possibly.
Possibly. So anyway, but you know, Teresa assured her, oh yeah, he knows about art history. He knows other stuff than just photography. But I was really kind of blown away when I did see her materials that, in my opinion, I think you are a photographer, Carol.
Oh,
It's not the only medium she works with, but you know, she does photo collage and everything. There are many behind you, on the wall behind you. She was also a fastidious documenter of her work. You know, slides on slides of all her works, and that, you know, we know how to piece them. You know how they were meant to be displayed and everything. And I remember, Carol, we had a conversation about how. We talked about your slide, all the slides you had, and you told me, I remember that, you really had to know how to be a photographer back in the day, because you really needed to know how to document your work, because that's how you applied to grants and galleries mm-hmm. and things. So I remember that quite well, and that, yeah, both being, I think Carol is a photographer, but also just, again, the how well she could, you know, document her work and process it. Some of the talks Dan and Naomi been having about how kind of the transfer of like an artist's materials organized in one way into like a, you know, archival best practices and such. But everyone who I worked with in this process and people following me, I mean, we've all said like Carol is super organized already. Some people just have boxes that you just throw stuff into, but you know, Carol had binders. My pictures like this, you know, binders with her materials, and they're all labeled, so you know, you actually can open it and know what to expect in there, and there were the things that were to be expected in there, so that's the
mostly.
Other thing.
Yeah, mostly.
Maybe one odd thing, but that's a good ratio there. so So there's that, for example, I believe Scott Watson even called it binder art at one time. Yeah. I have an example of that here. And so, and Carol also, she gave me a little nugget of wisdom one time too, is that she told me that if you, I guess her philosophy is that if you can't find something in 20 minutes, you haven't organized it well.
That has more to do with my impatience at having to look for things.
But it does help. For things, yes. Well, we all get impatient trying to find things that are terribly lost. But just that ethos and that it seems like, in your practice, like it's, and being an artist, part of that is being like organized and knowing your work, and because that also facilitates, that kind of work of applying the grants, applying for funding, which is very important when you're an artist, besides just making the stuff, of course. And I think that goes a lot too with the fact that, archives and collections are created because people collect things, and a lot of the writing about Carol has been about how you are a collector. You collect wood, you collect objects, mm-hmm. like the geese in the inlet over there. Mm-hmm. And I remember going into your apartment, you telling me about all the geese or the non-geese decoys you bought and painted them into geese.
Yes.
And a lot of the writing around you talks about, I think you talked about it yourself, this obsession with collecting wood and recycling works into new things. And a good example of that in the show is Western Blue Rampage, which is just like a floor spill, which I think got reused in the performance, The Float, which I think is in one of these video screens, maybe the one back there.
That's right.
Yeah, and then The Float got used in the beach assemblage, which is over in the back corner over there. And then the beach assemblage got destroyed eventually, though, when you got evicted from the Blue Cabin site. So there's that movement there, and now it's gone, but we know about it from the archive as well. Which leads me to my next topic, which is, the archive, as documentation and showing things that only exists now in the archive. As Carol, you've had a lot of works, you made a lot of things throughout your life, and you haven't kept everything. A big one I wanted to focus on was one called Bilateral Bend, which really most people wouldn't know about unless they look in the archive, because it doesn't exist anymore.
That's right. Buried it.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I saw that. So you buried it. Yeah. Bilateral Bend is this work here. It's like a projection and a fabric work, I believe.
It's a type of fabric. This is just a maquette, so you're not seeing exactly how it looked. I never could mount it. It was too big for this gallery, too. At least that was the excuse at the time. But it's a picture that you've probably seen many times if you've lived on the West Coast. I should say an image. And when you see a still ocean or a still lake and you get a reflection that's almost identical to the reality that you're looking at, it's kind of magic. You stand and look at it. And then if you look at the photograph and turn it sideways, you've got a whole other thing happening in the image, because the bilateralness of it all shows up really, really intensely. And I noticed this really strongly, really amazingly on my first and second trips to Haida Gwaii, and then realized I had to go back a third time because I kept running out of film. In pre-digit days, it's happening now, I'm sure, too. You took an awful lot of slides or images, and you had your garbage can right below your light table, and you were just tossing an awful lot away until you got the ones you wanted to keep. And I really love this, and I was there also because I was obsessed, and I love obsessions as long as they're healthy and productive, in what bilateralness was. And I see it in an awful lot of indigenous art too, and I see it in our landscape everywhere, like from everything from a clam Can people at the back hear me? Because I can't tell if I'm amplified or not. Raise your hands if you don't, and I'll get closer. Okay. And I look at that kind of bilateralness that's in indigenous work, say in their totems and in an awful lot of their wood boxes, and so much that they made. And I kind of wanted to know, or knowing that what they saw with this was this incredible landscape up there, what triggered them, what especially triggered it to become bilateral? And quite frankly, I couldn't find it. I'm not quite sure. Maybe it was just a totality that they lived with all the time. I don't know. What happened here is that you're looking in the lower part. No, you've moved on.
Oh, sorry, I'll come back.
The lower part of the maquette is about 12 feet by 8 feet, and it's made in 4 sections. And I used, a neighbor had knew I collected everything, so it kindly unstuffed her mattress that she didn't want and brought in 8 garbage bags full of this weird cloth. Apparently it's called kapok. I'd never seen it before. But there it was, and I had it sitting in my studio for a long time, and I thought, I got to use it. You know, I've got to do something with it. So I bought a lot of high-quality dyes, and I started dyeing it all over the house we were in at the time. And it took dye very well. So then I used, and it was just in little tiny clumps, but just, you know, so much of it. And so then I decided I would center it on these, well, basically big plywood panels. And I used rabbit glue, which I'd met when I was working in theater back in the early 60s. In Vancouver, rabbit's glue is a theatrical glue. It's made actually from some part of the rabbit, I think the bones, but it's a very comfortable glue to work with. And I was putting this image together, and I'd scaled up the bilateralness and stuck all these things on. I really felt like I was gardening. It had a really lovely manual feel to it, and the glue didn't wreck your hands. It kind of grew into you or something. But I had as close a facsimile as I could make of this split image that I'd seen up in Haida Gwaii. And then I also had the image, and I had a really lovely photograph of it that I enlarged and projected it on the screen at the top. So then I made a bilateral out of the bilateral, or I doubled it up. And had used up an awful lot of space, and eventually and ultimately I had nothing to do with it, so I buried it. And this doesn't happen too often, but when it does, you know, you look at something that was a year and a half's work, and you say goodbye, you know, because you can't seem to carry it to the next place you're moving to, and you can't seem to exhibit it anywhere. So it now only exists in this very awkward format. The upper photograph it's not a good photograph from here. There's a lot more to the piece than what you're seeing up there. But that's the story behind my adventure with bilateralism, if that's a word.
Thanks so much, Carol, for explaining all that. I just want to say that, too, these pictures are my pictures from going through the archival material as it is in the Belkin now. And, you know, it's part of this is showing, you know, me, you know, the act of sifting through the archives. And what Carol was just talking about is just really what I think is the pleasures of archives and collections. Like, it was great, you know, Carol, you know, going through your stuff with you, you know, right next door to me, literally, and, you know, being able to ask you about things, you could tell me all this, that, you know, the archive lives with you as well. You know, it's not just the objects, this is like, I guess, a write-up you made about bilateral bend, I think just also shows how well you document your work and how you envision it, basically. And I want to say about bilateral bend, I don't know if you see this, Carol, but I think with the movements of your work, too, I see like the inlet almost as a spiritual successor, and that you're wanting to replicate natural phenomenon, which I thought was really interesting when I talked to you, because we talked about the the shiny bit parts of the inlet, which I saw propped up in your apartment, and you wanted to replicate the shine on the water mm-hmm. with the light, and that was the Burrard for sure, and this was Haida Gwaii. So mm-hmm. it's kind of similar interests in the shorelines of the mm-hmm. Northwest mm-hmm. Coast, yeah. And in this case, replicating the natural phenomenon of the bilateralness, the symmetry you saw in the tides there.
For those of you who are standing, there are seats without back support right up in front if you'd like to sit down.
Yeah. Am I okay for time?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got a couple of minutes. Oh, okay, great. Let's see. Yeah, and like Carol was saying, how I've mentioned before, you know, beach assemblage in that photo collage in the back, that was destroyed and you're evicted from the Burrard foreshore. There's another work here that only exists in the documentation called Desolate Combination of Objects, mm-hmm. yeah, which is shown by the print gallery over there, which also some parts were destroyed, right? And it's also been moved around to your neighbors when you have to move mm-hmm. as well, right?
I gave one piece to each neighbor. So.
Yeah.
And said that way I knew how I could find it if it needed to be displayed anywhere. And I do keep touch with them.
Just like your rattles, too. Yeah. They've been dispersed as well, yeah. Which I think is really cool, which is great. That's why you have artist friends. And Desolate Combination. Yeah, just when you move from your old house, Hawks Avenue, you know, it's a very large space, and you move into your smaller space, now you just space, right? It's just practical things.
Yeah.
Just like that. And it has, you know, big effects on an artist's work in practice.
Yeah. When I was invited to show here, I was so thrilled to hear from Melanie. Then she said, "Would you like to show here?" And I said, "Oh yes, I could fill up the place twice." And I could, couldn't I have? Yes. You know, there's a lot of stuff. I want to go back to you thinking I'm organized, because I don't think I am.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I may have got that piece of paper into that file folder, but it's not in chronological order. I was just so happy to be able to grab a file folder that had a correct title on it and go clunk, you know, and get the paper into it. But you may, when you got into it, you found out that it wasn't in chronological order. But I knew that wasn't going to be too difficult to sort if needs be.
Oh, I mean, yeah, because, well, I mean, at least you had, you know, we go back, you had labels, which is like step one. you enclose them in something, which is step two, and the stuff that was on the labels is actually in there, which is step three. Because it could be like, you don't know. It's just a jack in the box, you know, certainly any system could use more work, it's like some people just dump things in the box, but you had labels and things, and because you're also so fastidious with documenting things on your CV, for example, we could, you know, we can link things up, and I think that was part of a lot of the research going into your show here. So, so like, oh, you know, like Desolate Combinations made in the 80s from your CV, so you know, okay, they're all these things were probably made around the 80s, because and that's like great already, because other time is just guesswork.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So don't sell yourself short on that.
All right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I just quickly flash this image, because that's what used to be in this geese binder. So more photo collage, and it's like really cool. I like this a lot. My last piece is an archival item titled "What Curators Do," and I think it's, when I came across this, I thought it was fantastic, because I love, you know, art is a very elitist thing sometimes, and that unfortunately stops people from wanting to get into it, or I think they can get into it, but I think Carol's practice too, that she uses like everyday recycled items. You made a whole piece about the Strathcona neighborhood from things you found in Strathcona. It's, I think that's really, can be really relatable with people, but you know, artwork is not an elitist thing. It's just, it's governed by every other thing that governs the world. So this was a great example. So this is a picture of the log from the Desolate Combination being moved out of Carol's old house that had a big attic studio. And who was the curator again that was doing this?
The curator was Todd Davis. He was from Victoria. And he's the one standing high on the ladder behind the branch. And I took a whole set of images of the log coming out of the low window in the attic studio, of the log coming out and then down the ladder, and then I glued them all together. And he said, and I said, this is what the curators do. Is that the term? Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, thank you so much. I'm going to send it to my mother. And I could understand that. What you can't tell from the picture is just how big the studio was. It had 11-foot ceilings, peaked roof, but from the angle of the camera, you don't see that part of the roof. But it was a lovely place to work.
Yeah, and again,
the log is wrapped in plastic there as it came out the window. I knew that the windows were big and square, so I made the log diameter of the log exactly as big as a window, because I knew I couldn't get it through my trap door. So, and they were keen, you know, to do this.
Yeah, it's again, the pleasures of the archive. You find stuff like this that you see these works in the gallery. You see these rattles, for example, in the gallery, and they're like, oh, okay, don't touch. I mean, they do have, I know they have floor things here to not touch them, but in this video, well, actually, oh, nice. You can see kids rattling the rattles right there as Carol told me they shouldn't be.
Please don't rattle them here.
And it just shows, you know, art's just like anything else, you know, people can... just throw art out the window. So, like, maybe there's definitely a lot of artists who wanted to throw art out the window. So yeah, I think that's just great. You know, it really brings it down. You know, brings it back to earth. Bring things back to earth. And you know, art's not more special than anything else. It's, you know, it's just another part of life. And I think Carol, like, you know, your art is part of your life, and it really shows in your organization and the materials you document. Because I think anyone who's gone through it can really get the sense of your life through them, really. Mm-hmm. And I know you're a journalist too, and you're a writer, so I think that all kind of comes together in the diarist. So I think it really all comes together there, and it was just really a pleasure to look through everything and talk to you. Yeah,
well,
and I guess that's where I'll end.
I think I've had a really special life in a sense, because I've never wanted to do anything else. Lucky me.
Yeah. All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Brandon, for that. Thanks, Carol, of course, for being here, and Naomi and the Belkin for having us. As Naomi said, I'm a librarian. I also work at the Artist-Run Center Grunt Gallery. I'm the archivist there over in Mount Pleasant, here on these unceded Coast Salish lands. And Carol has shown at Grunt a few times over the years and performed. And of course, Grunt is one of the organizations that is behind the Blue Cabin Floating Artist Residency. So the collection of material that we have there, a lot of it is around the Blue Cabin. Given that this show does such a rich job of kind of backgrounding Carol's work and projects and practice, as well as what you just said, Brandon, I think today I'll focus a bit on the Blue Cabin. And I thought, kind of for back to school, because we have this collection of stuff for the kind of back to school feeling, I would do a little, almost like a little show and tell here with a few objects that I feel like speak to some of the themes that I think of and that I really value when I think about Carol's work and when I think about the cabin and the archive. So the first theme is actually a bit of an acknowledgement, looking a bit backward from my entry point, which is, you know, only 10, 12 years ago or so into knowing about Carol and her work. Some of the stuff that has been done before that really reflects Carol's care and creativity in the arts community here in Vancouver. And I was chatting with Flaky before the presentation here, and he mentioned the Ruins in Process site. So I have a website from 2009. This is a magazine ad for a website, and we did that a lot more. And this was a combined project of Grunt and the Belkin here. And of course, that's the raw egg costume image that's in the show here and also over in the Kerner Library, which is just such a cool and enduring image. And then I also have this item here that is, and actually I realize this is like the lighting and the space and everything is pretty whack for show and tell, but afterwards, maybe I'll put them out on the table, and if you're around, you can come up and have a look. This item is a tile here from a fundraiser that Grunt did in 1994, if I'm not mistaken. We moved into our current space. It has your name on it. And this was made by ceramicist Bill Rennie. And it was part of a fundraiser by which donors would have their names inscribed in this tile. It's very beautiful, intricate work. And then they were mounted on the wall of the Grunt. However, following a renovation, we tried to remove them, and many of them did not survive the removal, but this one did. So I thought it would be nice to put it in there. And I actually quite love this as an object. It's pretty amazing up close. So I have that as well. But I just think, like, in terms of, you know, supporting an artist rent center and being in the community, that those are pretty important things to me. So I also wanted to talk about the cabin. Oh, thanks for bringing those up. In a sort of like archival knowing through place, the cabin obviously being a very unique and special location, and Carol and Al's presence dating from there, the late 70s and the late 60s respectively, and the setting of the cabin itself, the nature that surrounded it, the land, the water that it was on, the kind of intertidal zone that it was there, all as agents of creation, agents of transformation, agents of what I think of as persistence and a kind of embodied and community memory. And so to illustrate that, I'm going to share a couple.
Did I draw that?
You did, yeah. A couple hand-drawn maps. This is an elevation. Is it okay to share the hand-drawn map? I love this thing personally, but this is from August 2015. And there's two views. There's this kind of side elevation view, and then there's this overhead view. And there's so many details here, but I'll just mention a couple. One is that both of these say, drawn from memory, not from photographs. And to me, I love that little tidbit.
I do too.
Yeah. It's like the embodied memory of the cabin. There's tons of photographs of it. You know, one could draw from photographs, but the idea that you were approaching making this map, which was eventually used in a lot of, you know, heritage reports and all this kind of documentation and really, like, you know, fundraising ammunition that we used to get that project off the ground, to have something like this that just has the hand of the artist, the memory of the artist, and the embodiment of being in that space for such a long time. I love that about this. There's another detail. If you see, like, there's the shoreline, 14-foot tide, and then just above it, drift logs, and there's this shape here that says always changing. And I love that about this as well. I think if you're familiar with the cabin and its site, you know that the tide had a huge impact, and the influence of the environment around there, storms, rain, tide, animals, to say nothing of the geese, you know, had an effect on the art that Carol and Al produced together and separately there, which I think is super cool. So to follow up on that and to kind of move closer to the structure, I have also this latch, which was on the door of the cabin and made its way into our collection. I believe when they mounted it as part of the residency, they needed a new latch for it. But this is, to me, this is a really cool sigil of the kind of activation of a space via the presence of an artist.
Can I see it?
You may. Yes, there you go. I think about opening the door, entering the space, and how that could bring it to life, and how something like a latch, you know, it speaks to all these questions, some of which we talked about, you know, who's locked up today? Who got the wood stove going? You know, these things are really important. And they're kind of like these domestic tasks that underlie the process of creation in the space, without which, you know, I mean, I remember you talking in a lecture before, you read a page out of your journal and you quoted, or perhaps quoted in some intergenerational wisdom from your own mother. You said, if you're going to stay there, then do something.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like this moment of, like, you know, keeping the space maintained. Mm-hmm. And then also just, like, I don't know, we do a lot of work around accessibility at Grunt, and as a tactile object, this latch is amazing. The action on it is really good. You know, it feels good in your hand. The click is real nice.
Was it on the front door that you took it from?
I didn't take it off. It was delivered to me by the cabin staff. Okay. But I believe it was from the front door, yeah.
All right, because I don't think we ever used it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You could have just gone in and out.
We had a padlock and a what do you call it, there's a name for the latch of a padlock.
Oh, okay.
We had to replace it once or twice.
But, yeah.
But this one we kept because we liked the look of it.
It's a really cool object, yeah, and there's just enough of the blue paint left on it.
Would entertain a 2.5-year-old for at least 15 minutes,
definitely,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah, thinking about that. Yeah, the tactile quality of it's pretty amazing. And to speak of the door, I have also this note, which was posted on the door. It reads, "I'll be back shortly. Please leave a note. Al, Watchman." So part of the cabin's arrangement and being the last structure that was in that area was an agreement with the neighboring Mackenzie Barge and Derrick Company, a shipbuilding yard for which Al Neal worked as the watchman. Initially, he paid rent, $15 a month, I recall.
He did. Uh-huh.
And then over time transitioned into a kind of exchange of being the watchman for the rent.
I can't quite remember what happened, but I think one month he couldn't find the $15 or $20 to pay. And they said, oh, forget it. Just stay there.
Just be the watchman.
You know,
right?
Imagine. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that was super cool. Again, like artist as laborer, artist as a part of this kind of maritime shoreline functioning community. There's this idea that the people living in these shacks were squatters and they were all artists or hippies, but there was a lot of laborers and maritime folks living there as well. So I think that to me, this is kind of like the invitation to leave a note to communicate with an artist. And also speaking to the precarity at that time and until now of space for artists to live and work in this place that we live, which is, I'm sure, on many people's minds all the time.
Dan, the picture you had of the cabin is a double exposure.
Yes,
yeah.
We're getting to that
one. Okay.
Do you want to
look
at it? Okay. Yeah, and leave notes they did. So you, during the response to the eviction, collected some of the notes that were left, which I think multiplied in frequency after some news articles came out. As a means of kind of demonstrating the community support for the cabin in the response to it. So there's some notes here with people's contact information. I won't be sharing that, but there's a few tidbits on here that I thought were quite cool. One of which is a note that you have detailing where the person had suggested about the history of the cabin, 1932, and you've annotated these beautifully, which I think is very much kind of speaks to what Brandon was talking about and your kind of impulse to continuously go back and inform your archive, remediate your archive, and add to it from your experience. So this one is details. 1932, Norwegian brought it here. And this was from someone named David and their wife who lived across the mudflats. Has 4 Chihuahua dogs in pink winter vests and a very sick, large Chesapeake Bay retriever. So I think that these like little details, I love that, as well as contributing to the actual history, which before is like, it's pretty murky. The original inhabitants of the cabin, not a ton is known about them. I have this other note from Wendy. The note is whatever, but Carol's annotation is, "I have not seen this lady Wendy since I was 5 years old."
Oh, right. She was my best friend at 5 years old, and her husband came to say hello and left a note. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's like, what could bring a person back?
Yeah.
Right? These notes are left after a B&E through a window on the desk of the cabin.
Yeah.
Somebody came in, "Thank you, I love your little getaway. Is it your home? I apologize, yet I had to help myself to some books. Sorry." Smiley face, and then they've signed their whole name there.
It was the gentlest B&E we ever had.
Right? Like, thanks for the books. I don't know if you remember which books went
missing. No, because there were too many there.
Too many books, yeah. "This place is the most amazing home I've ever seen." Just the penmanship makes me think this is by a child. Cabin, maybe you always be. What a place, what memories, what peace, what art, what solitude. And it goes on like that. It's very heartwarming. Lots of nice notes. But I thought it was super cool that you kept these. And I guess they just speak to the kind of the cabin's place in the mind of a community of people that knew about it or would visit it, even though it was, you know, a private place in many ways. It was there as well. Okay. Another theme I wanted to talk about is the idea of archival, like a disruptions, agents in the archive, kind of trickster aspects, destruction, development, and the kind of generative potential of these disruptors. So here we will go to the double exposure. This is, you know, this is one of the least blue images of the Blue Cabin, but it's also one of my favorite. 1984, a double exposure of high tide and low tide. And you've spoken before about how the tide was so important in terms of the landscape there, how the tide affected things like the assemblage and the rowboat, the presence of flotsam and jetsam and everything else, and of course, just the kind of way that your work interfaced with nature and the potential for creation and indeed destruction out of that as well. So the assemblage that was on site, very specific to the site, not really intended for public presentation or consumption. And I think I remember you mentioning something about the pleasure of making something that you knew wasn't ever going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
It was something that kind of sat with me in terms of thinking about art in different spaces and gallery spaces. And I think also in terms of working in archives, because a lot of the work that we do is very much in isolation, and it involves creating and modifying records and stuff that, you know, may or may not ever be viewed. So I like this, and as a double exposure, I think it's pretty cool.
I went out in the rowboat, probably to where it was about 6 feet deep, and I had triangulated myself between two trees, so I thought I was in much the same position, but I'm not. There's you can see I'm about 8 or 10 feet off. That's not quite how big the cabin is. I wanted to go back and say something about Al, because he was there quite a few years before I joined him there. And what I learned from him was how valuable it was to have such a, I don't know, privacy while you were there. And it included loneliness, I suppose. But we lived there with almost no neighbors, really. And we saw very few people. And it's terribly easy to become a recluse. And it was valuable for him because he could read all the time, and that's what he loved to do. And whenever he did hear a whole group of people coming, he would just freeze. He'd say, you know, it was one of his continuing nightmares, is that a whole bunch of people would arrive at the door and say, hi, we're here to party or something. And it sort of did happen once we got the eviction notice. You know, there were so many people coming around. There were days when there was 100 and 150 people on the beach just scouting around and looking and stuff, because there'd been so much publicity. And the publicity was necessary in order to save the cabin. And what happened was, with the incredible energy of the Grunt people and quite a few other people too, that it's now an artist residency. So you know, it has its it really worked. You know, it's worked all the way along for various groups of people, the cabin.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. In the process of putting that residency together, we had a couple artists. They live between Main Island and also in Greece, Jeremy and Seuss Borsos. And they, after the cabin was moved off site, they performed a kind of creative heritage
autopsy.
What do we say? Yeah, an autopsy, restoration, remediation of, to restore it back to you know, ship shape of being able to be on the water. And in the process, Jeremy Borsos, who's a meticulous documentarian, removed many things from the cabin, many items that he found, many pieces of wood, and documented them all. And amongst those, on the subject of disruptions, he found pieces of wood that had been kind of eaten into by, and I wanted to clarify with you, is if this was a carpenter ant situation or termites?
That's what he called it.
Carpenter ants?
Yeah. It was fumigated a couple of times because they were eating through the beams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As well as these mud daubing wasp's nests. Right. So I have them wrapped up, but there's no wasps here, so no worries, you know. But yeah, I thought these were kind of cool in terms of like this, you know, as a private place, but of course sharing always with nature and these kind of additional denizens of the cabin.
It sounds very romantic, but you know, it was hard work living there, and the term about hauling water and wondering if you're getting any stronger comes right from that time, because we had no running water, and it's a difficult way to live, and probably maybe a third of you have tried it out, maybe through camping or where you live, but it's hard to do. We really value running water, and I think every great culture has had running water, really. It's just essential to life.
Yeah. There was the spring underneath.
Yeah, there was a weird little spring underneath because we decided it was a spring because there was always water dribbling along there, even when the tide was way, way out. You know, it mm-hmm. should have emptied out, but it hadn't.
Right.
And we decided it was a spring from somewhere. It's certainly not anything you would drink from. And even the place where I hauled water from was about maybe 100 feet. I'm still in old-fashioned measurements from the cabin, and it was a very rocky beach. So there I would be hauling water and thinking, well, it's good for my posture. And how long can I keep doing it? And I thought to myself, forever, you know. I have no choice. The way that's how we live there. And that water was tested once, too, and it was full of the wrong kind of bacteria. So we put a little dollop of bleach in it before we washed the dishes in it. And we didn't use it for drinking. We brought drinking water from the city. So we were, still fairly attached to the city while we were there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I love that. Again, I love that embodied memory of your back hurting hauling the water.
Yeah, and I always had to wear my laced-up boots, just so that I didn't, twist an ankle or something. I'd be about 65 and thinking, oh, this must be good for me, and then they'd like hell,
Yeah.
Yeah, the shoreline. I'd rather be able to turn a tap on, thank you.
Ever-changing that shoreline,
Yeah.
You can twist an ankle or something. So from the wasp nests, we had a resident in the cabin in late 2022, an artist called Keely O'Brien, who made a number of presentations and objects based on her experience in the cabin, including this little 8-panel zine called Dream Homes of Non-Humans. Mm. And this publication was created in a building that once had wasps and mice and everybody else. And I'll just read the wasp page because I like it. How to manifest the dream home of a wasp. Use an electric drill to make holes in the exterior walls of buildings. Welcome the occasional pain of a sting as a small tax to pay for the huge wealth of being human. And I like that. I think there's a certain humbleness that runs parallel mm-hmm. to your mm-hmm. the way you consider yourself and your art and nature. There's a few more things here in terms of disruptors and destructors. I have this list prepared by Al in 2010. A vandalism report from the cabin. I won't read from it because it's a little bit of a bummer, but I will say that it's a pretty, as an archival object, it's a pretty raw reminder of just kind of human carelessness and the kind of potential for entropy, which I feel like in the profession that the two of us are in and many of us, I'm sure some of you as well, in terms of preserving this stuff, it's things like this that remind us about the importance of that kind of work because, I won't read from it. Lastly, I kind of wanted to talk about the kind of enduring and inspirational reach of the cabin, this as a project, and the practices of Carol and Al as being something that just, at the point of need, mobilized so many artists and so many art workers, and yourself as the kind of genesis for this. So thinking about this project, as you said, very well documented, well publicized in the news. Some clippings here of Jeremy and Suze Borsos during their excavation of the floor and finding all these antique posters for prize fights and magic shows and everything like that received a bit. And then also this image of the cabin being mounted on the platform that it still currently floats upon. This is at a shipyard. Vancouver Pile Drivers in North Van, and shown here is Esther Rausenberg and Glenn Alteen from C3 and Grunt Gallery, respectively, but not shown, of course, Barbara Cole from other sites, the other agent of driving force behind the cabin. And what I really think, too, is in terms of giving credit to everybody who's behind the scenes and who does that invisible work, especially arts workers who create supporting things, and there's a dozen of them or more here at the Belkin. But I think, of course, folks like Vanessa Kwan, Megan Koos, Carlene Harvey, documenters like Krista Lomax and Henry Robideau, and folks at the periphery of our profession, like Andrew Todd and Harold Kalman, folks like Michael Jackson, who all played a small part or a big part in this like extremely complicated project. So I just wanted to kind of shout out arts workers, because to me, arts labor is, it's something I'm very passionate about, and I do feel like it's important to keep it in the record as well. And I guess I'll share one more thing on the subject just before.
Okay, last
should we cut it up? That's it. Okay. These are just some Christmas cards that Carol sent. Really nice, a nice card, holiday card if you want to see it. A photo diptych. Or actually, that's the mystery card. This is the holiday card. Yeah, one of them was sent to Grunt with a happy holidays message, and the other one was sent to us without any writing or any return address on it. So it was a matter of matching the text on the address, the handwriting.
I think I purposely
left it off.
Well, disguise my handwriting.
Yeah, it was a big mystery for about a week who'd sent us this. It's called Besieged Cabin.
I thought you might like to use it and mail it on to somebody.
Oh, no, we're keeping that.
It's a back view of the cabin, and it's what's in front of it is nothing but blackberries that I could never cope with. I just couldn't get rid of them. So you never really walked around that way anyway. The rest of the three sides were painted a lovely blue, but backside was, and this is one of the, when the they were drilling around there, we were living in the cabin, and they were putting these great big shafts down to, I guess, to test the land to see how contaminated it was. And they were there every day in their white hazmat suits. This is the land we lived on, you know. And they'd be like 6 or 12 feet from the cabin and using these huge pieces of equipment and drilling down, and then they put a cap on it, oh, wrong card, with the date on it, and there it was, you know, another measure of where we were. And then they told us it was contaminated land and we'd have to leave right away. And I thought, we are really healthy and we've been here like 35, 40 years. I don't understand what they're talking about. It's not like we went out and dug up the land and sat in it and ate it, you know. We weren't that gross. It was hard to take, you know, it really was. And Al was getting really on. He was close to 90. And he had broken his hip, a bad break of his hip, and it really slowed him down. And it was the same day we were supposed to meet with the officials from, take a big breath here, what was it called, Vancouver Port Authority? Yeah, and they were coming out to the cabin, and where were we? Al was being transported to hospital in an ambulance. They were planning on how they were going to tear it down if we didn't move immediately, or they gave us a month's notice. And so it was a hard time, you know. It was a really hard time. I don't think Al ever went back there, and he'd be recovering in his wheelchair in our apartment in Strathcona, and I'd be on the phone talking to somebody or other about the cabin. He'd be, Glenn, you've heard this so many times, and he'd be sitting in his wheelchair, and he'd be yelling, burn it all down, burn it all down, you know. Meanwhile, there was just this super active set of people that got around to preserving it, you know. It was a very special story.
Is that where the you have on the back, Besieged Cabin there on the back?
Yeah.
That's where that came from.
2013.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a nice thing to receive, for sure. So yeah, I'll leave it there, but obviously that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of maybe kind of whimsical objects and very cool things and some of the things that they evoke that are quite special to me as I think about my good fortune to know this story.
Thank you, Carol, Brandon, and Dan. We do have a couple more minutes. Does anybody wish to ask a question or comment? In the meantime, I'm just going to wrap up with a couple of, while Bahar gets the microphone, there's just a couple of things that have come up throughout this talk that have sort of stayed with me. Many of you are talking about ideas about what is an archive, right? The archive isn't something that we've traditionally thought of as things filed in an institution or organization. The Grunt clearly has a different way of understanding and organizing and thinking about an archive, care for the artist in relationship to their materials. The Balkan has another way of doing things, but I think that what's come up is that the archive is an expansive kind of way to organize and think about artistic practice, in this case, Carol. It's clearly been brought up that what you do has made us think about things in a very, very different way. And then the other thing is that archives, and in this case, Carol's, have led us to think about artistic practice in a very different way. And that there are gaps in history and a gap in the way that we think about artist productions and or the way an artist produces things. And that means that we have to also rethink about the way that we formulate an archive or how we're going to take care of things. Okay, so there was one question in the back. Did you want to hold up your hand? Great.
Hi. People hear me from this? Okay, no, I can hear myself. Okay, my question is for Carol, and it's actually just to sort of expand on what Naomi was talking about how the archive, we can think of the archive as sort of a more expansive way to think about artistic practice, and it's from sort of my understanding that there is sort of a lot of politics and a lot of debate about, especially in institutions, when collections, you know, get to institutions, what is considered to be a work of art that is placed in the institution's collection, and what is considered to be part of the archival sort of materials, the sort of the documentation, and the sort of the implication behind that is that the archival materials are somehow, you know, supplementary. They're not sort of centered in the same way that the works of art are in the collection, and I wanted to sort of ask Carol, what are sort of your thoughts on how you see that sort of binary as it sort of pertains to your own practice? Do you see it as a thing, or do you see sort of the things that are in your archive as being sort of works of art in and of themselves?
Oh yeah, it's quite easy to answer that because I think at the time I was, to me, archives are mostly papers, right? And at the time, I never saw it as archives in what I was doing. I was just storing stuff so that if I had to respond to some letter or do something about it, I could reach back and see it. I never had that self-conscious idea, really, of using the word archive at all. It's happened since then that it's been called an archive. And I could probably say without exaggeration that about 35% of it is refusals. Okay? I saved them all, yes. Are you nodding your head?
You
noticed?
Right.
I don't know, Carol. Yeah, I've seen those for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, not to focus on so-called failures, maybe.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, those are really interesting. And you annotated those as well with your own.
Oh yeah, I put little comments.
Yeah, yeah, which are really.
I forgot about
really
them.
Really great. So just a reason to go access the archives. But yeah, I mean, same with what I was talking about with the log. So I guess those are great. This goes away from the question maybe a little bit, but yeah, those rejection letters were kind of great because it reminds you, yeah, you know, you do have a show here right now, but it doesn't mean you always got a show everywhere else. And yeah, the art world is tough sometimes, and it's hard to make space for everybody. And I think people forget that. And you just focus on, like, oh, the artist as this, exalted figure or whatnot sometimes, yeah.
Does that answer enough of your question? Yeah.
Maybe one last one? No? Okay, thank you everybody for coming, and thank you Carol, Brandon, and Dan.